You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hi, I'm Tanya Pinkins, and you're listening to my podcast, You Can't Say That, on the Broadway Podcast Network. I envy my next guest. She gets to call a spade, and she doesn't get branded an angry black woman or difficult, which is what I hear about myself from people who don't know me at all. And she gets to create in every venue imaginable, from Broadway to off-Broadway to regional theater to the West End to television and film. Maybe it's because she's so remarkably talented and makes so much money for everybody. Please join me in welcoming the brilliant artist, Katori Hall. My name is Tanya Pinkins, and you are listening to You Can't Say That podcast on the Broadway Podcast Network. My guest today, I'm so excited. I am sure that there is no other black woman, but I think that there's no other woman who is working creatively at the level of success and brilliance on as many fronts as this woman. She's currently represented on Broadway with the musical Tina. She's an Olivier Award-winning playwright for The Mountaintop. Tina just came from the West End. She is married. She is the mother of two children under five and under. She is the showrunner on a new Starz TV show called Pussy Valley.
Yes,
P-Valley on IMDb. And she has plays that are all over the country. When I met her in 2012, I think she already had written a dozen plays.
Yeah.
And I want to know, what do you attribute this amazing capacity to just create and express at such a high level?
Insanity.
Well, okay, let's be more insane, people.
It's interesting. Okay, I think the first thing is being a black person, being a black woman, there is this need, and it probably is unfortunate, it may be subconscious, unconscious, this need to kind of represent and to prove other people wrong. So, you know, oftentimes, particularly when I started creating, I would say my first plays were not critical darlings. I wouldn't even call myself a critical darling, but I just felt like I needed to always be crafting narratives, you know, with black women, particularly at the center. And so knowing that there's this huge scarcity of material for black actresses, black folks, I was like, well, I'm just going to fulfill, you know, everybody's needs and dreams. I'm like, I'm going to get everybody a paw. You get a paw. You get a paw. You get a paw. So I kind of think it first comes from that place of just wanting to die and have left 100 plays on the shelf or 10 TV shows out there. Or just knowing that my ancestors, they were not given the opportunities. They were not given the platform. And so it's like, damn, it's 2019, 2020 next year. Like, what the fuck am I doing? Like, I gotta create another movie. I gotta create another TV show. So it's this kind of like fervent need to exist on a community level. And I think just on a personal level, just proving people wrong. Because at the beginning, you know, people were just like, oh, you know, you doing that black stuff. And then you writing about black people that even black people don't really want to go to the theater and see. You know, they cussing and fussing, they pole, they this, they that, they dealing drugs, and they want to prostitute. And it's just like, well, those people exist.
Mm-hmm.
And I come from those people. And when I go home for Christmas or I go home for Thanksgiving, I see those people.
Mm-hmm.
And you
love those people.
And I love those people. And so I want to, you know, create empathy because I love them. I want people to love them as much as I do. And so, you know, it does, I would say, come from that place, which is almost kind of like a political need.
It's an odd thing that, you know, are sort of considered the great American playwrights, Eugene O'Neill, you know, Tennessee, Arthur. They were writing about working class people.
Yeah.
And that was honorable. And now today I feel like there's so much about just ennui. It plays about ennui. We want to see ourselves be just doing nothing.
It's funny. I must say, I don't go and see those plays. I always feel as though if I'm going to spend my time at the theater or if I'm going to create anything for the theater, any story, it got to be something that is about some kind of change.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I also just feel like, you know, they were writing working class people, but I feel as though when working class meets whiteness, it's seen as honorable.
Except for Lucy Thurber, because, you know, they don't like her either.
I don't get it.
Because she's writing about poor white people and they're not supposed to exist.
I love her work.
I love her work too.
I guess I wouldn't call her a new playwright, but just, you know, a female playwright that, you know, she's kind of writing my heart. Right. Like, I want to see those
people. I know the people in her plays, even though I don't come from Appalachia, but she's writing what I grew up with.
Yeah.
So where's the energy come from?
Energy. So it's funny. My assistant was talking to me yesterday. He was like, bitch, why you don't drink coffee?
I don't either. And I have a lot of energy.
And I was like, I just don't know why. Yeah. I've never needed the kind of supplement. I just have this fuel that comes from passion.
Yeah.
It's just like, I want to see all this stuff. And also I feel like I can, like, I feel like a lot of people are like, oh, I can only do this type of work. I can only write plays. I could only, write short stories or novels. And I just feel as though for some reason, and I think it has a lot to do with just, I always had a lot of interest growing up. I just feel like, well, if I read a book about it, can I do it?
Right. I love that.
Yeah.
I was with Brandon Jacob Jenkins. We were talking about you, and he was saying he felt that you were the most unsung of his generation, particularly because you do everything. You've written so many kinds of people, so many kinds of stories. It's like you read about it, you develop characters about it, and this sensuality and the passion and the language and the place is just extraordinary in your work.
Brandon said that about me. I know that boy. Yeah, it's interesting. Unsung. I think, you know.
I mean, you're sung. You're getting a lot of play. But, you know, you're working.
But maybe not a lot of respect. I would say that I'm probably not as respected as
what does that mean?
What I mean is, it's kind of connected to that thing of the whole kind of critical. How are playwrights unfortunately defined as being good in our industry?
And right now they're defined as being good if they're writing about slavery and we slaves or we getting killed or we begging for us to stop being oppressed. That's what I feel at the moment, and I'm not even interested in it. And I'm like, we are so much more than that. We are so much more than that. Like, the ones of us that survived slavery, we are outstanding. The weak of us died out. Mm-hmm, so mm-hmm. we are just like the strongest.
But what do you mean by that? You really feel like people feel are like kind of getting validated or getting a pat on the back?
Yeah. Look, if you look at all the plays that were nominated for awards last season, somebody was either dying or we were slaves or something like that.
Yeah, it's that thing of like, how do you, because the critical mass is who they are. They are who they are. They tend to be white men. They tend to be gay white men. There is this kind of lack of cultural knowledge and an unwillingness to accept and critique from a place of not understanding and being okay with that. So anything that kind of caters to a particular kind of, I'll call it the white male aesthetic in terms of Western narrative, how Western narratives are constructed, anything that kind of caters to that kind of container or structuring of a story, they tend to applaud it. Anything that feels like it is created specifically to teach someone about you or your culture, that it tends to be validated. And then those of us who are kind of writing without this idea or feeling of gays, black or white or anybody, we tend to, you know, a lot of us are, I think people who are doing that, they're just presenting black folks and blackness as it is without trying to explain it. And I think that kind of infuriates those people who are tasked with trying to, you know, write about and provide context for a mostly white audience. It must be frustrating for them But we tend to, you know, keep on writing whatever we write.
Right. And like, it's frustrating for us to just be all day long, every day. Like, and they live with a little bit of frustration for like 2 hours or the time it takes to write something and be frustrated and like, I can't do this well. Oh my God, I've got to wrestle with it. I'm going to have to go learn some. I have to do some research to figure out how to actually do my job better in the context of something I don't already have experience and knowledge of.
Yes, exactly. It's funny. I was doing some research on Lynn Nottage, and I looked at her first New York Times review by Ben Brantley. I think it was actually his first review he ever wrote. And it was very interesting. He was very, it was Crumbs from the Table of Joy, and just very dismissive of it, and called the title sentimental, not knowing that that title is taken from a Langston Hughes poem. So it's this thing of folks not knowing our gods, our illusions, and being given this huge, very impactful platform to tear us to shreds without understanding who our gods are.
Mm-hmm.
So I always like think about that and be like, girl, you know, just keep on writing your, you know, 5011 plays and your 5011 this and your 5011 that. I'm trying to become a film director like you.
Well, I saw Arca Buca, which is a beautiful film. I actually worked with your DP on a film.
What?
Right, we did The Artist's Wife with Lena.
That was in Connecticut,
Lena
right?
Olin. Yeah, we out in Southampton and stuff. We shot that, but Arca Buca is beautiful.
Thank you.
Beautiful. Looks black and white. Beautiful. And yeah, a powerful story.
Thank
you know,
you.
It's like there's a feature film in that.
Yeah, there is a feature film in that, you know.
I want to know what happened.
I want to know if the Black Cowboys.
Did he get his jet ski back? Yeah, it was very powerful, very powerful.
Thank you.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUPS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUPS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUPSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on Essie Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
Yeah, and no one is talking about, I mean, because I don't know, I didn't see a list of your publicist for you, so it's not being, do you have a publicist that's listed on IMDb?
I don't have a publicist. People keep on like, girl, you need a publicist.
Clearly
like,
you don't need a publicist. You work and doing what you want to do. I think people get publicists to try to get a job.
Really?
I don't know. I don't have one.
I don't have one, yeah.
But you also, on your series, all women directors.
I did. I fucking did it. I don't know how. It was hard.
Why? What made it hard?
So you would think that the subject matter of Pussy Valley, which is, as you said on IMDb, P-Valley.
Right.
Because people scared of pussy. They were scared of it. They couldn't. They were like, oh, no, we can't say that out loud. You would think because of the subject matter, you know, you would be able to. Well, maybe, why am I saying that? Why am I assuming that women want to talk about pussy or women want to, you know, help to tell a story that, you know, centers marginalized women, you know, very much in the forefront in that it's a show about strippers, strippers down south, strippers in Mississippi. I think a lot of people assume that it's going to be about a bunch of titties and ass, but it's not.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for me, the strip club is being used as this prism to dissect what the intersection of race, class, and gender in America is, which I think every strip club is that, to be honest with you. So you would think that, you know, women would be like, you know, running, coming to interview, but it was challenging. I had a lot of women who were like, oh, I don't, you know, clutching their pearls. I don't want to, you know, waste my talent on that. There was one. Yes, there was actually someone who's like, I don't want to use my talent to tell that story.
Okay.
There were people who were like, well, why can't she want to be a tennis coach? Like, why she want to be a stripper? Why can't she be one? You know, I'm like, because ain't nobody really playing tennis like that in the hood in Mississippi. Mm-hmm. But despite, you know, some women's kind of respectability politics, I would say, I found through a lot of interviewing, you know, a group of women who were passionate about the show, understood what I was trying to do and what I was trying to explore. And I, you know, I said to my network stars, like, from jump, like, I'm committed to having an all-female directing slate. And so, not to say that stars said this, because they had actually done the same thing, I want to say, with Vida, which is Tonya Sirocho's show.
Okay.
Another amazing playwright. But, you know, we had to kind of admit how hard it was, because it's that thing of people being ready for what your show is trying to do. And what I mean by that, it's like just having the experience, mm-hmm. the resume to come onto a set and build a show from scratch with a showrunner. Mm-hmm. It's not a lot of women who have been given that opportunity. So if you don't have the experience, how are you gonna come in and know what to do? And even besides that, it's the thing of just like, when you are on set and you're a woman, you have to kind of, you have to prove yourself. And it's very unfortunate. You know, my pilot director was actually making the shift from music videos, Karina Evans. And, you know, she's told me so many stories. Like, even if you go on her Instagram right now, you know, she's talking about in her latest job where someone asked, you know, like, where the donuts were. You know what I'm saying? Just, like, not
right, assuming
that she actually was, you know, the boss,
right?
She the boss. She running the set today, and for the next couple of weeks. And so it's that thing of you, and then sometimes you're not questioned, but you question yourself. And so, you know, I was just very blessed to have the support of this network, and who were, you know, we were willing to wait, and figure out people's schedules, and just so that we could have this all female slate. Because I was very much interested in what a female gaze perspective of this world is. And quite frankly, I think a female gaze perspective of any story has a lot to do with, like, how do you, you know, where is the focus?
Mm-hmm.
You know, where is the camera? Is it over her shoulder? Like, are you embedded in her, you know, POV, like, camera placement, movement, you know, lingering versus, you know, lingering on someone's breasts versus being like, no, her breasts are a part of her job. We ain't got to linger on them. Mm-hmm. Like, what is she going through? And mm-hmm. it's really about, you know, those choices. And so I had a lot of conversations with the directors, but I will say, not everybody had a female gaze.
I'm sure. Wow.
which I found, not every, you know, woman who is directed has a female gaze.
Wow. And so what is that difference when a woman doesn't have a female gaze?
I think there was one instance in particular where there was a lap dance that we shot. And so the character as, you know, doing this dance for these two guys who are doing this business transaction. And she's kind of part of the transaction. Like, you know, if you come, no, don't go nowhere, don't go nowhere. She gonna dance for us. She gonna dance for us. Kind of the, do I need to move? Kind of like the carrot dangling, right?
Right, right, right.
So The first time we shot it, it was like no coverage. Like, it was a oneer. And they say, like, oneers don't exist in TV. And they fucking don't. And they shouldn't, and particularly in this instance, where you had this beautiful, gorgeous woman sitting on these two guys' lap. Her tits are out, and you can't understand or hear anything because you're looking at her beautiful breasts. Like, it was insane. So I was like, fuck, how are we going to? And it was a mistake in that day, I think we ended up running out of time. I think time wasn't managed well on set. And so at the end of the day, we were like, oh, shit, we got to shoot this scene. Let's just do it in the water instead of being And it was funny because they had prepared, you know, for the coverage, right?
Right.
So, you know, studio sees it. And they're like, right. Katori, what the fuck are you trying to do? And I'm like, but it's said in the strip club. But even I knew that the story was not being told.
Right.
Because if I'm just focused on her breasts, you know, I ain't hearing nothing. So I assured them, I was like, with coverage, story clarity and character development will follow. So we ended up having to reshoot it and, you know, break it down. You had all kinds of shots. And your medium, your close-up, you know, dolly in, dolly out, you know, reverse, yada, 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 yada. And then, you know, we put it together. And it was like, you know, a glorious scene in the second episode. Like, it's really beautiful, really, really smart in that you don't actually see her breasts like twice. Really, but you're watching how she's listening to the business transaction so that she can one-up them later. Because it's about how the power dynamic can switch in a space like that. Yes, it's a space of exploitation, but there are some women who can find pockets of liberation within that space. Yeah. And so that, to me, was just like an example, kind of subverting the assumption of like all women are being exploited in that space.
Right.
But it was so crazy that the director had this very male-gazy entry point into that particular scene, which made it looked like we were exploiting
a woman. Right.
So it's so tricky. It's so tricky.
I think about that because, like, I don't remember her name, but she funded John Brown. And she was this maid who worked for these stockbrokers, and she would listen to the tips.
Yeah.
And she found a white man who would invest for her. So she was very, very wealthy until he died, and then his wife didn't give her anything.
Mm.
But someone hired me to, you know, do a race read of their screenplay. And, you know.
Oh, they do that? Race reads?
Yes.
That's interesting. We'll talk about that later.
It had a black woman in it, and it was like some murders were happening, and girls were disappearing, and a white woman comes to town to find out where her daughter went, and it turns out the black woman's daughter is missing, and the two women don't get along, but then they suddenly get along, and somehow the white woman's fight gives the black woman the right to fight. And so the woman's like wanting me to tell her about this thing. And I'm like, well, first and foremost, the black woman already knows what's going on, who did it, and why.
And why? Because
we are treated like we're invisible. So we know all your business.
So we know everything.
We know everything.
Yeah, yeah.
We know all your business. You just ain't worried about us telling. So the black woman not knowing, it doesn't make any sense. Okay?
Interesting.
She knows, and this has been going on forever. She knows who. And the question is why they suddenly switched to a black girl. They've been doing this for decades, and now they got a black girl. That's the question for me.
Yeah. What and how did they respond when you gave
them?
They
were like, oh, like they had never.
It's like a light bulb.
Like a light bulb. Like, oh, that this black woman in this town actually has some agency and some knowledge in a place that she has grown up and her whole family has grown up in. It was like they were grateful for the information. Whether they changed the script, I do not know.
Yeah, we always figure it out.
Yeah.
I mean, how did we get here if we didn't figure out how to, in this exploitative space that is America, figure out how to liberate ourselves in big ways and small ways. Laughter being, you know, a small way.
A great one. One of my friends says that the only people Jesus saved was the American slaves, because we bought into that narrative and we was like, we gonna be exalted for all of this suffering that we going through.
I don't know. Maybe. I don't know.
That's my theory.
When promised land comes.
I don't know where the promised land is. I also want to ask you, in this TV world, because I don't know, I hear from so many playwrights going into the TV
world. Yeah, a lot of us are like, woo!
But you seem to be, so I hear from so many playwrights that they're in the world and they're just fighting for their vision, and that everybody's having their vision being turned into, you got to center the white person in the story, you got to center the white person. How are you navigating that?
I mean, I just don't.
P-Valley doesn't have that. I don't think that's even in the script.
Yeah, I just don't deal with that. Yeah. I think I have I'm very forthright when I come in and I pitch and I, you know, talk to these network executives, and I think their forthrightness possibly turns them on. I feel as though the best work, the best anything that you create, it can only be good if it is coming from an individual who has a very particular vision. And whatever that vision is, the network, the studio, they just have to buy into that vision and let you do your thing. I must say, I don't know whether they was just going through a lot of stuff at the company, but they did not, you know, meddle with my story and what I want to say at all. There was like, oh, she ain't ran no show before. Oh, give her $50 million, whatever. We'll see how it works.
Wow, fantastic.
But that is because of, you know, the people working at that place. It has nothing to do. Now, I would say it's changing in that, you know, the president of Starz, Chris Albrecht, who is the person who greenlit my show, ended up walking away from the company because I don't think he was on the same page with the new buyers, Lionsgate, which came in and bought the company. So he walked away. Marta Fernandez, who was my network executive, ended up, because Chris walked away, shifting over. She's now the head of television at Macro, which is Charles King's company. Mm-hmm. Because they saw that there was like this sea change happening where I would say probably Lionsgate is not interested in niche programming and niche stories. I'm waiting to see if that's true or not. So I got kind of caught in this unfortunate space where, you know, I remember 6 days before my first day of shooting, they called. I was like, well, you got to take $1 million out of your budget. I'm like, where'd they do that at? Like, 6 days before I fucking shoot, and you're telling me I have to cut $1 million? I barely have enough as it is. And I mean, people listening to this will be like, me, girl, shut up. But like, that money, it can be spread really, really thinly. And it, like, to do 8 episodes of a TV show with that many series regulars, with that many stunts, with that many, like we would have like 300 extras per day because it's set in a strip club.
Right.
Like you cannot come and snatch money away. And it was because, you know, that thing of value, like, well, you don't need that. So we're going to nickel and dime you. Like if it had been, you know, the previous guard, they would have been like, maybe can we give her more? Because we understand what she's trying to do. I always feel like, you know, women's stories and Black folks' stories are the first to get nickel and dimed. I don't know what I did. Oh, I think I told on them. I called my agent. I was like, mm-mm. Which is sad that I don't have her right now because, you know, we have to fire our agents because of, you know, the pending strike.
Right.
So it's like, ah. But anyway, I called her and I was like, God, they're trying to, you know, take money away from me. And she called and, you know, she, you know, cussed and fussed. And then I got a call within 6 hours and they were like, okay, we're not gonna touch your budget.
Well, that's good. That's a good story.
But it's interesting, you know, my agent's a Black woman who's like, yeah, very much, you know, in alignment with what I'm trying to say. And awesome. And supporting my stories. And, you know, it's not that many of her out there.
Right.
So
who is that?
Ashley Holland.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well,
her. Yeah, we love her. I was like, I miss you. I'm like, when is this going to be over? This whole, like, I don't know.
Right.
I'm actually going to, renegotiating our contract again. So I have to go to the Writers Guild tonight and, you know, get the lowdown on what's happening.
This is Tanya Pinkins. Thank you for listening to part one of my interview with Katori Hall. Part two is coming up next.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but
yeah.
Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.